Good morning, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Investigator Perspectives on Available Clinical Research Findings in Renal Cell Carcinoma. We're here at the Hilton Hotel. We've done a whole bunch of satellite meetings this weekend. I know a lot of people have been watching online. We had quite a few people here live today. But we're doing this webinar to sort of give you a little bit of live from ASCO, what happened in terms of RCC, but also review where we are today in general in the field. We have a great faculty today joining me today, Dr. David McDermott from the Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston, and Dr. Monty Powell from the City of Hope in Duarte, California. Today, we're actually going to go through some basic issues in renal cell. All weekend long, we've been talking about this survey we just did over the last couple weeks of 75 general medical oncologists. Well, we asked them also about RCC, and they gave us about 800 questions. We picked a few of them out. We'll try to squeeze them in along with questions that we get from you on this webinar. So we're going to start out talking a little bit about what happened here at ASCO, and then we'll sort of kind of dive into the general topics that we're going to get into. Particularly, we'll start out talking about what everybody has questions about, which is the management of metastatic disease. Then we'll talk about adjuvant therapy, also an area where there are a whole lot of questions. And we'll finish up talking about non-clear cell. But let's talk about some of the papers that came out. And one, Dave, I'm curious what your thoughts are. We were chatting a little bit about this, looking at the issue of continuation of IO in patients who've been treated with an IO TKI. And I guess we saw some data looking at, maybe you can talk a little bit about this study, looking at Nivo with Cabo in the second line.
Right, so I think you're talking about the CONTACT-03 trial, which looked at cabozantinib with and without atezolizumab for patients who had failed prior PD-1-based approaches. You know, the good news for our patients is their overall survival is improving as the immune checkpoints move up earlier in our algorithm for treating patients. But there wasn't a lot of randomized data about how whether PD-L1 can salvage a PD-1 failure. We do this in the clinic often where we cycle through all of these doublets. This study suggests that that may not be a good strategy because essentially atezo did not add any efficacy to Cabo, and it did add some toxicity. So until we have positive randomized data, we should probably pull back on that practice of switching from one PD-1-based combination to the other. The only sort of caveat to that is there is some evidence, limited, that ipilimumab in the setting of PD-1 failure has some activity, several trials suggesting ipi gives you about a 5 to 15% response rate, but once again, no randomized data in that setting.
Yeah, well, you know, Monty, when we first started talking about, you know, continuing IO and progression, and thanks for correcting me there, it was atezo. My first thought was exactly what Dave just said. I hear a lot of people talking about in all cancers using ipi-nivo after single agent IO, but I was very surprised the two of you were telling me before we get started, you see people using doublets, sequential doublets, so, you know, cabo-nivo and then pembro-lenvatinib?
That's absolutely right. You know, Neil, we're seeing this more and more in our clinical practices. Folks will actually sequence combinations of TKI and IO. And I don't think this is just a renal cell issue.
Right.
You know, my colleagues at Hepatocellular, for instance, might sequence bevatezo with lenpembro. You see this across other malignancies. What I love about CONTACT-03, and this study is very near and dear to my heart, we just published it in The Lancet simultaneous with the presentation yesterday, is that it's a really pure comparison of the contribution of IO in the second line setting, Cabo plus or minus. There are other examples of studies that have looked, for instance, at chemotherapy versus a targeted therapy plus IO and lung cancer. Mm-hmm. But this really gives you a sense of the contribution of that second line IO, and it's pretty disappointing.
Right.
So I want to ask you about a couple other orals there in advanced RCC. One I know didn't surprise you, but I just thought it was really cool, looking at the CheckMate 9ER study in terms of health-related quality of life. These quality of life papers are starting to get better. In the beginning, I could not follow like what it meant, but now more of these patient-reported outcomes. And the thing that was cool about this, I mean, again, it's probably no big surprise to you, but just sort of thinking about it, was that in terms of quality of life, patients did better with the nevo-cabo than sunitinib, which I think is a reminder of the pre-IO days when we were all debating about which TKI to use. Right. Is that what you see in your clinic?
Well, there are differences with the TKIs and side effects, which often translates to toxicity. I think one of the important aspects of that comparison is that in the 9ER trial, the starting dose of cabo is down from 60 milligrams to 40, and that may contribute to reduced toxicity, better tolerability, fewer dose reductions, and improved quality of life. I think the question, though, for us is when you're reducing the dose, are you losing anything on efficacy? And that's a debate that we have, but it's certainly an active combination.
It's pretty hard to separate out the doublets, too, in terms of efficacy. So it seems like it's working. But again, Monty, is that your experience? I mean, you know, pembro, lenvatinib, we hear lots of stories about lenvatinib in general, you know, endometrial cancer, HCC, not necessarily an easy drug to use, a lot of debate about toxicity. Does it make sense to you that specifically cabo-nevo may be better tolerated than, you know, some of the other doublets?
You know, I describe it to my colleagues as sort of like a Goldilocks story, if you will, where, you know, when we look at the dose of len that we use in the second-line setting for renal cell, it's 18 milligrams. We sort of up that in the front-line setting. With cabozantinib, as Dave correctly pointed out, we're dropping the dose from 60 milligrams to 40 milligrams, and with axitinib, sort of staying at the same dose in frontline versus second line. And, you know, to me, this quality of life data really stands out as a differentiator. I tend to use more cabozantinib nivolumab frontline for my patients versus the other TKI-IO regimens. And so I do think that from that perspective, it's very helpful data.
Yeah, it's very interesting, too, because, of course, we've been watching these debates going on about the doublets and, at least in terms of efficacy, you kind of get the feeling they're very similar, but very interesting in terms of tolerability. I want to ask you about another oral in the advanced RCC section. Dave, I've been fascinated by busulfan and where that's heading. There's a paper with a belzutifan plus lenvatinib and a clear cell. Can you comment on that and that strategy and where you see belzutifan heading?
Right, so if you were to ask, you know, what's the next potential big thing for kidney cancer, we hope it's targeting the HIF-2 alpha transcription factor, which is an important driver of clear cell kidney cancer. We haven't been able to target it. Belzutifan does and has activity as a single agent with a 25% response rate in previously treated patients. It's now in a pivotal trial versus everolimus. In the salvage setting, we'll see what that shows. But we're now seeing combination data that looks interesting. You know, it's all single agent, but there is a biologic rationale, single arm. It's all, the rationale for targeting both HIF-2 and VEGF. So we're seeing those combinations. There also is an adjuvant trial of HIF-2 plus PD-1. So if HIF-2 becomes a drug in kidney cancer, there are multiple companies looking at this. It potentially will impact all levels of treatment for kidney cancer.
What do we know, Monty, in terms of tolerability of belzutifan? Any unusual issues there?
You know, the things that sort of stand out to me in terms of toxicity, there's nobody that knows more than about HIF-2 than Dave. He runs one of two kidney cancer spores in the country that's done a lot of work on this pathway. But hypoxia and anemia are the two things that really stand out to me as...
Hypoxia?
Yeah.
Like clinical hypoxia?
Yes.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Like
80 shortness of breath type hypoxia?
Often associated, but sometimes disconnected with shortness of breath. So if it becomes a drug, it will present a challenge, a learning curve for clinicians about how to manage it. But all in all, tolerability is much more favorable with a drug like belzutifan than with our TKIs, which have a longer list of toxicities.
Do you ever need oxygen?
Some patients do temporarily. It quickly reverses when you lower the dose or stop the drug. But it is, you know, your face says it all. It's one of those things that it's not something we're typically used to managing in our patients, and we're going to have to get used to it if it becomes an approved agent.
Another new side effect. You know, we've got all these ophthalmic things. We did a whole program just on eye issues in oncology. It's like every organ. So that's, can you just like explain a little bit more about the biology of this? Because particularly the sporadic.
Right.
Like, first of all, is there anything on NGS like to look for that helps predict whether people will benefit?
Not yet, although we're looking, because it doesn't work in a lot of patients. So the question is why? And the question is, can we select ahead of time to make it more effective? Most clear cell kidney cancer, those patients have a VHL mutation in their tumor, VHL being a tumor suppressor gene. So when you're missing it, you can't shut off the HIF transcription factor. So it accumulates and it drives a variety of genes that are pro-tumor. So the idea being if you can block the activity of HIF2, you can shut off a lot of these genes that cause problems for our patients. But it doesn't work in all patients, and we don't quite understand why, and we need to, so we can give it more selectively. But the hope is that as we learn more, we'll increase the activity and help more patients, because we're doing more with VEGF blockade. We're just targeting one gene that HIF2 controls. Here, we'd be getting more.
What do you do about the anemia?
Well, that's interesting. With holding the therapy, it improves, but we also are giving erythropoietin with belzutifan, and it quickly responds. So EPO is one of those target genes for HIF2. So when you block it, your EPO levels fall. If you give it, you know, to the patient, they come back up, and patients feel better pretty quickly.
So, Mani, you're going to talk about adjuvant therapy and management of non-clear cell in terms of papers here at ASCO. One, more data, adjuvant ipi-nivo was presented here. Any thoughts about that and why it's a negative trial?
Yeah, you know, the data was first presented at ESMO last year, and there's an important update this year on some of the different histologic subtypes, PD-L1 expressing subsets. But I have to tell you, I was shocked by this when I saw it last year. You know, after I saw the positive adjuvant pembrolizumab data, I thought, well, gosh, add CTLA-4? More impact, right? So when the curves were just completely overlapping, it struck me. I think most of us have come to the conclusion there's probably a toxicity problem. Lots of people with grade 3-4 events, lots of people discontinuing therapy, Nivo-Ipi, lots of people getting steroids. Mm-hmm. Dave's made that point before. So I do think that all of these factors probably really sort of temper the effectiveness of adjuvant Nivo-Ipi.
So yeah, Dave, I'm curious about your thoughts on that. I mean, you think Pembro works. I say Pembro and Nivo should be the same. You've got Nivo there. I mean, is it that much steroids and all that really negate that effect?
Possibly. I don't think we really know. I think that's the safest assumption. I think what's interesting, though, from Dr. Motzer's presentation this year, as Monty alluded to, they're looking at different subgroups of patients and their benefit. And his numbers and his analysis were small, but they get at sort of a critical question, which I assume Monty's going to get at in his talk, is who should get adjuvant therapy and who shouldn't. Most of our direction with that approach is based on clinical stage, but here he's looking at biology, and there's, you know, certain things that are associated with benefit that did seem to drive some outcomes, even in that trial that was all negative for all comers, but in sarcomatoid patients, in PD-L1 high patients, the activity seemed greater, and that might sort of give us a way forward to improve selection with adjuvant treatment, which is now the standard of care.
So a few papers here in non-clear cell. Mani, that's an area of expertise for you. So first of all, triplet, Cabo, Nivo, Ipi. I'm curious about your thoughts about that as well as in RCC in general. This is a non-clear cell that was presented here. We also saw data with Nivo, Cabo. Also, I didn't even think about this, sarcomatoid non-clear cell. Interesting in terms of impact of immunotherapy. What did you take away from these papers in terms of, you know, sort of non-clear cell?
You know, we're starting to see this signal across multiple studies now where a TKI plus IO seems to really have substantial impact in these non-clear cell histologies. I think the data for Len-Pembro is quite compelling. Response rates in histologies like papillary of around 55%. The data you alluded to for Cabo-Nivo and histologies like papillary has a response rate of 47%. I do think that we need randomized trials in this space, and I think we've proven as a community that we can do that. And I'll tell you why, Neil. You know, you look at the small randomized phase twos that I've, you know, done in the past, mm-hmm. and they really have an influenced guideline. Right. So one of the things we'll be talking about is phase three designs in the non-clear cell space that can ultimately displace drugs like sunitinib and so forth, right. Still in many parts of the world represent standard of care.
Interesting. So just want to point out also to the audience, there are a couple of RCC education sessions actually today, this morning, if you go check them out. I always love the ASCO education sessions. I noticed one of them is on oligomets. Any comments about that, Monty, in terms of how often you use strategies targeting, local therapy for oligometastatic disease.
Yeah, I think the principle's starting to become pretty similar to other diseases mm-hmm. like lung cancer, colorectal, where you really start aggressively targeting oligomets and renal cell. Truthfully, we've done this for a long time with surgery. The data that I think is perhaps emerging and maybe more compelling nowadays is for SBRT and radiotherapy mm-hmm. in that setting. I'm getting more and more comfortable. When I was in fellowship, I was taught that renal cell is a radio-resistant disease. We're learning more and more that oligomets can be effectively controlled with SBRT. I don't know if you...
Absolutely. We often integrate it with systemic therapy for places where patients' disease escapes. So, for example, bone mets, brain mets, and then often go back to continuing what the patients were on with systemic therapy. So we work closely as a multidisciplinary group at most centers, to offer both approaches.
I don't know, but for some reason, my head just clicked into, as I mentioned, we're going to show you some of the questions, these 800 questions we got from oncologists, but I just flashed on one of them. I don't know why when you talk about oligomets, because it's sort of debulking in a way. Again, Monty, update, 2023 update on cytoreductive nephrectomy. The way I've been hearing it is that the patient's not symptomatic. And they have metastatic disease, particularly if it's symptomatic, treat systemically, hold off on cytoreductive. How often are you doing cytoreductive nephrectomies?
Unfortunately, I think the 2023 update is we don't know, which is kind of unfortunate. But, we've had the pendulum swinging back and forth with trials done in the cytokine era and then the TKI era trials there being negative. We do have studies ongoing. There's a cooperative group study called PROBE, which randomizes patients to cytoreductive nephrectomy or not. But I think the important point in the design of that trial, and this really reflects my clinical practice, is you get the systemic therapy regimen going, right? And then you make that decision around cytoreductive nephrectomy later. So if you have that patient who's doing great, wonderful responses everywhere, I probably would not send that patient to cytoreductive nephrectomy. On the other hand, if every other site's responding and all that's left is the primary, we do see cases like that, then maybe that's a place where you might consider really debulking in that case, in the true sense of the word.
Right.
All right, well, we asked both the faculty to do short presentations, and then we'll lead into throwing out a bunch of questions from the general medical oncologist. So, Dave, we ask you to talk about the complex world of metastatic kidney cancer, if you could go through that for us.
Sure, glad to, Neil. A lot's changing, improvements in overall survival for our patients, which is great. When we were doing this, maybe... 5 or 6 years ago in your place in Miami, the standard of care was VEGF blockade first, then PD-1 is salvage, and that probably doubled overall survival for our patients, that sequence. Soon after, the question was, can you combine these approaches? And there certainly was preclinical data that suggested you could. So looking at essentially the fusion of first and second line therapy, that sort of hit the big time with this study 4 years ago, which was updated this year at ASCO, which is the KEYNOTE-426 trial, looking at Pembro and Axi versus sunitinib. And most of these randomized trials that have come out since have the same sort of design, which is VEGF PD-1 versus the old VEGF standard of care, and have shown similar things. The alternative approach, which has been looked at in other tumors, is two checkpoint inhibitors, PD-1 and CTLA-4. And Dr. Motzer showed us a few years ago that that was an active regimen. So what we spend a lot of time debating at these meetings, we now have, 6 positive phase 3 trials, 4 of which are positive for overall survival. And we spend a lot of time discussing, which regimen should we use? And there are, people who have different approaches. These are sort of my clinical take-homes, which is essentially if you have aggressive disease, symptomatic disease, you need disease control. Well, PD-1 VEGF regimens have a higher response rate, a lower primary progressive disease rate, a longer PFS. So there are certainly pros to that approach. There are some downsides about chronic toxicity because you need to stay on both drugs, but less intensive immune-related adverse events, which is obviously one of the downsides of PD-1 CTLA-4. But for those clinicians, those patients that are looking for a durable response, what we're starting to see is those emerging from that original CheckMate 214 data set. So there are pros and cons. So what we see in the curves over time is, this is looking at the curves from KEYNOTE-426, is you see a drop-off in some of those PFS curves. And ideally, what you'd want to see with an immune therapy is what we see on the right side of this slide, which is a plateau on those curves. Whereas, and you see that's across trials, so this is the PFS curve that was updated at ASCO GU, looking at 9ER, which is Nivo-Cabo. You see a similar pattern. Also, in overall survival, though, maintained, you know, across subtypes, which is great for that combo. Clear data, also impressive for those early endpoints, response rate, PFS, but you do see some fall off over time in progression-free survival. We debate what to do with favorable risk patients because there's no clear impact in overall survival in those patients, which is puzzling. And we need to understand it more. Whereas with the CTLA-4 combination approach, you see less early activity, but you see that plateau now at 60 months, which was the most recent update in the PFS curve. So there are patients living with durable benefits, some of whom are actually off treatment, in part because of the tox, so they're living in remission of their disease. So it becomes a trade-off of our patients willing and clinicians willing to accept the increased toxicity that comes along with that for a potential for a durable outcome. And it's not for every patient, it's not for every clinician, you need a team. This is sort of how I look at it, the pros and cons, and there are good justifications for either approach. And the bottom line is moving PD-1 early has improved outcomes. This was something we were talking about before. This was what we hoped would be the next step. So this is sort of the kitchen sink approach of combining all the active approaches, VEGF blockade with Cabo, and then PD-1 blockade with Nivo, CTLA-4 with Ipi. This is the so-called COSMIC 313 data set. This is a positive trial for its PFS primary endpoint. So this was met. This was published just a couple weeks ago in New England Journal. The issues with this approach, though, have to do at least with tolerability. There's more side effects when you add the triplet, particularly hepatotoxicity, and we haven't seen survival yet. So until we see survival, the application of this approach may be limited in the clinic. We'll have to wait. And if we don't get survival, this may not become an approved approach for our patients. The biggest question, I think, in oncology, or one of the biggest, is what works after PD-1 failure. So we obviously deal with that a lot. There is good data going back several years. Dr. Shueri, you mentioned him before. Monty has certainly been part of this. With looking at cabozantinib, certainly approved there, certainly active there. Tivozanib is another player in this space. Monty's led a lot of this work. This compared here to sorafenib, not just benefit compared to sorafenib in the salvage setting, but durable benefit with a clean toxicity profile, as you see here, and is certainly FDA approved. Dr. Atkins recently updated some of that data, and what you can see is durability, which we don't often see with VEGF TKIs. You see a separation in those curves that is lasting out to 4 years. So it's certainly having a role. It's moving up earlier in the algorithm, you know, potentially. You know, and this is a subgroup analysis for that TiVo-3 study looking at treatment-related adverse events, which seem less with TiVo than with some of the other regimens, other TKIs that we've had, so maybe a somewhat cleaner TKI, which is an issue. So certainly VEGF blockade is a standard for a salvage setting in patients who fail PD-1. But the question which we were getting to before is, you know, does PD-L1 salvage those patients? And this is the CONTACT-3 design that we talked about. And at this meeting, we learned that essentially this trial is negative. And so we probably shouldn't be doing that until we see positive randomized data. So hopefully, you know, if we're doing this again in a few years, what we'll get to is a more biology-driven approach we've sort of talked about, which is the treatment based on a profiling of the tumor and its microenvironment. And we'll get to having more patients living in remission, so second-line therapy will not be necessary. We're moving towards that goal, but we certainly have a lot of work to do.
So just a little follow-up, here's some of the questions we're going to talk about, but I've got to say that seeing that data that we were just talking about in terms of quality of life with the doublets really got into my head. I hadn't really thought about the issue of the TKI pairing.
Right.
And, you know, what we were just talking about, that with the Cabo being a little bit lower dose and, you know, maybe a significantly better quality of life. I'm curious about, because I know there are studies looking at TiVo plus IO. I don't know how far they are along or whether that's ever going to, but does that make sense? If it's, is it, in your experience, better tolerated? Do you think a doublet with an IO would be better tolerated?
You know, great question. Important study, TiNivo 2, which is looking at tivozanib versus tivozanib plus nivolumab. Very interesting design there. So they're actually using the standard dose of tivozanib versus essentially two-thirds the dose of tivozanib plus nivolumab. The setting's also a little bit different, Neil. So it's for patients who have progressed on prior immunotherapy. Mm-hmm. So in some ways, it reflects
the CONTACT-3 design. Yeah.
So the study's going to be an important, I think, arbiter in some ways of the role of PD-1 post-previous immunotherapy.
Right.
Different question, important trial.
Yeah, no, but to your point, I mean, I think the intensity of toxicity is greater with PD-1 CTLA-4, but the chronicity is the issue oftentimes with VEGF PD-1 strategies. And there, factors come into play, like the half-life of the drug, for example. So, for example, if you have diarrhea, which can happen with PD-1 and can happen with VEGF, how do you tell which is driving that toxicity? So the easiest way is to stop the drug. And some of these drugs have pretty long half-lives, so it's not easy to understand that. Whereas a drug with a shorter half-life, like axitinib, that patient will improve within 24, 48 hours. So it makes the management a little simpler with certain agents. But there are trade-offs, you know, efficacy and tolerability for sure.
What about the triplet approach, the COSMIC approach? I mean, the hazard rate for, you know, recurrence is pretty significant. I think it's 0.63. Mm-hmm. Granted, there's no survival, but you were alluding to the issue of tolerability. What actually do you see? Like, what's the problem or the challenge?
Yeah, I like Dave's summary. I think a lot of it hinges on overall survival, which we haven't seen yet. In terms of tolerability, big issues, right? So the rate of steroid use was much higher with triplet therapy versus doublet therapy in that trial with nivo-ipi alone.
I wonder why, though. I mean, why would cabo affect toxicity?
It was a placebo-controlled trial, Neil, right? And I think that had a lot to do with it, right? Because you run into toxicities with these triplet regimens, in particular hepatotoxicity, and you don't really know what to chalk it up to, right? In a placebo-controlled trial. So no matter what it is, you're going to throw steroids at it, right? So I think that's probably what led to these higher rates of steroid use than I would have expected otherwise. So lots of issues when it came to toxicity, liver being probably the most prominent. But, you know, until we really see a good signal, maybe in terms of OS, I just don't think it's going to pick up in the clinics.
Right. So a lot of questions about sort of the ins and outs of using these therapies, including in the chat room. Hassan wants to know, for patients with bone mets, is cabo preferable due to better bone efficacy? We've heard that. Curious about your thoughts on what the data is, and would you use it as a single agent or with nevo if papillary? You're going to get to that in a second. But any thoughts about cabo and bone mets? And also, one of the docs had a case that they sent in, 6-year-old metastatic RCC on nevo cabo. Restaging shows one new lesion in the jejunum, which incidentally I'm curious about that. Patient's clinically well. I guess you could say this is oligo progression. So what about cabo and bone mets, and what about this case with oligo progression, David?
So the cabo and bone met story comes from like a subset analysis from previous trials looking at either nevo cabo versus sunitinib or cabo versus sunitinib, which seemed to suggest a, you know, greater efficacy in those subgroup of patients. Those numbers are small, and we shouldn't overinterpret them, but we've used that as justification for using cabo and bone mets, and it tends to be what I do in my practice. That said, bone mets are a big problem for patients from not just a quality of life, but from a complication point of view, and I don't think you can count on any TKI dealing with that. So you need to work together with your orthopedic folks and your radiation oncology folks. So if someone has a bone met and a weight-bearing bone, I'm usually offering radiation to that bone so as not to deal with a pathologic fracture, which really can set patients back considerably.
Do you use preemptive surgery?
Our orthopedic surgeons are not big on that. They are often not to criticize orthopedic surgeons, but they're not able to predict when someone is going to fracture. But certainly symptomatic bone mets, we often try. If someone's having significant pain, it looks like the cortex is narrowed, we probably operate on them ahead, you know, more so they don't have the complication.
Monty, what about this jejunal met? Have you seen that with RCC?
Yeah, I've had a couple of seconds to think about it. So, you know, but I'll tell you, this is a case where I'd probably try to get the surgeons involved, and I'll tell you why. You know, I think these mets in the GI tract really spell trouble in a lot of cases. If these continue to grow, right, we know that further immunotherapy won't work. We know that switching TKIs might lead to bleeding-related complications when you have tumors at that site. So I'd actually see if you could potentially get a surgeon to resect this. Radiotherapy, I'm not excited about. When you have a jejunal met, right? The tissue there is just too friable.
Sounds like a Luger progression. He says the patient's doing well, no symptoms, they're under control. It's just this lesion. Yeah. So take it, Luger met, take it out and keep going, I guess.
Right.
Maybe the one thing to remember here is you'd want to probably stop the TKI with cabo maybe about a week or two ahead of surgery and then hold it for about a month after.
Right.
So you do run some risk of progression in that time frame, but I think it's a necessary evil.
That's a good point. How about this other case, Dave? 72-year-old man, severe pain from bone mets. We were just talking about bone mets. Patient's lenvatinib pembro. Any dosing recommendations about lenvatinib? That's a topic we talk about a lot, particularly in with the gynecologic oncologist, endometrial cancer. Half of them start a full dose, half of them start low dose. Again, I've been now my brain is more getting tuned into the TKI part of the doublet. Mm-hmm. Any thoughts, Monty, about lenvatinib dosing?
Yeah, you know, my philosophy here is that if you're going to use lenpembro in the upfront setting, you got to use the dose that was put forward in the phase 3 trial. Otherwise, you're not sure what sort of benefit you're going to tease out of it. Mm-hmm. I've had a lot of colleagues in the community who might, you know, kind of dial down the dose to 10 milligrams or 14 milligrams. I just don't know what that does for the patient, frankly speaking, and you might be better suited using the standard dose of another TKI IO regimen. I think that there's other diseases like uterine, for instance, where you may not have other suitable similar alternatives, but in renal cell, we're fortunate to have such.
Right. In addition to what Monty said, I think you should always be trying to maximize the dose, which often means backing off and or holding and then reintroducing it, because patients can often tolerate a higher dose, you know, 6-12 months later than they might have right off the bat. And I think oftentimes too much of what I see is a permanent dose reduction in, you know, in regular practice. I don't think anything needs to be permanent. It should be adjusted based on the patient's tolerance.
I hear a lot from the gynecologic oncologist, Monty, about the first week or two in lenvatinib, and they have these things about how they follow people, check their hypertension, et cetera, et cetera. You do that in this situation?
Absolutely, and I give patients really specific instructions on dose-reducing themselves. I tell them, do not try to be a hero and push through at the highest dose. Call us. You know, you've got the nice thing about lenvatinib is sort of the pills come in a manner that you can sort of titrate down the dose in many cases on an individual basis. So that makes the dose reductions a lot more easy.
So some more questions. This is a good one. I've been thinking about this for a long time myself. This whole thing about ipi-nivo and low risk or indications for ipi-nivo. So David, supposedly. You don't use it for low risk, but yet you show those curves and people want to use it.
Yeah, and we do. It's not indicated there, but once again, if you look at the short-term data, sunitinib is winning in the short term in the CheckMate 214 study, but the long-term data suggests that nivo-ipi is really helping patients. There's a high CR rate there. There are patients who are having durable responses. There are remissions there. So I'm biased to wanting my patients to have that opportunity, so I offer it. But there are obviously some trade-offs. I wish we could give it more routinely. I wish we could advocate for it more routinely, because when you look at the entire population for that study, it's a positive study when you look at all comers. So I think, in my opinion, I think the guidelines should change going forward.
So you're getting a lot of response about the issue of surgery. That's a very practical issue. So Matthew in the chat room wants to know, how about dental extractions, root canal procedures? Also, Iyad wants to know specifically exactly what your approach is with people with TKI IO who are getting surgery, Monty.
Yeah, so I will say that I probably have a lower threshold with dental surgery, simple surgery like that, where the bleeding might be confined, to actually just let them restart within a shorter time frame. So a week to 2 weeks is good enough for me in those circumstances. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just based on my clinical experience. I don't know, Dave, what your practice is there.
You know, I think the key issue is it above the gum or below? So if they're going into the bone, there will be patients, if they're on TKIs, who won't heal and sometimes can get an osteonecrosis situation, which is problematic. So the key is communication with the dental oral surgeon so that they understand the healing issues. And as Monty said, not restarting the drug until they've approved the healing.
So we're going to go on in a second and talk about adjuvant and non-clear cell. Just a couple more. A lot of questions about TKIs. And Monty, again, questions about TiVo. What do you use, second line? Can you talk about basically how you sequence TKIs? And in particular, what do you do with people who are having problems?
You know, I tend to be pretty, dogmatic, formulaic in the way that I apply therapy. So I tend to start with Cabo-Nivo with most of my patients. There's special circumstances, sarcomatoid, et cetera, I might go with a different option. So most of my patients are getting Cabo-Nivo up front. And that sort of takes away one of the probably preeminent options, second line, which is cabozantinib. So I tend to either use lenvatinib or everolimus if I have a patient with really aggressive disease. I find that regimen really hard to tolerate, though. Mm-hmm. So I'm actually putting most of my patients on TiVo right after Cabo and Nevo. Find it to be better tolerated. You know, Dave did a nice job outlining the data for it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what they were asking about, is second-line TiVo. Really interesting. So, we were just already talking about belzutifan. That sounds super exciting. Well, maybe at the end we'll talk about where we think things are going to be heading in metastatic disease over the next year or so. We might come back to some of these questions. We're getting some questions in the chat room. But I want to make sure, and it's good to just go to look through some of these things. This brings up an issue that we've been talking about this weekend in general, which is the use of IOs in people with prior autoimmune disease, David. And I think it was in our lung program, people were talking about the difference between a non-life-threatening issue like arthritis as opposed to pneumonitis, et cetera. And actually, somebody here asked a question about a patient with rheumatoid arthritis. How do you sort of look at pre-existing autoimmune disease when you're thinking about, for example, first-line therapy metastatic disease?
Yeah, so it's a critical question. Comes up a lot in the clinic. These patients were excluded from the original trial, so there's less data. But the data is starting to emerge because our colleagues in these other disciplines that help us are starting to collect it and work together. I think in general, my cut point of using it versus not is a balance between how serious is their autoimmune disease, as to use your term, is it life-threatening or not? So if someone has had life-threatening complications of, say, Crohn's disease, that may be a no-go versus something like rheumatoid arthritis, where if it flares, we can still get control over it and, not have long-term complications. So there's a balance there, but also it's about their disease. So do they have metastatic disease, and if we don't get this under control, they're going to have a shortened survival. I'm more likely to treat there. But in the adjuvant setting, it's often a reason not to do it. So it's a conversation with not just the patients, but also with building a team of folks who will help you manage these complications when they happen, because you do need their expertise to manage things that we don't deal with all the time.
So I think I have a feeling I know how you're going to answer this question from Blaine in the chat room, Monty, and maybe particularly because now the answer is different than it was a few days ago. Patients who progress on Ipi-Nivo use Cabo alone or Cabo-Nivo?
Yeah, so there's a trial ongoing in the cooperative groups right now to sort of address this concept in part, right? That's the Pedigree trial, which looks at dose optimization. You keep the Nivo going and add Cabo to it. I think the data, though, that we have right now from CONTACT-03 that we reviewed really suggests there's no point in keeping the IO component going at this moment. Mm-hmm. I would just give that patient a single-agent TKI.
All right. Let's talk a little bit about some of the data we have right now with adjuvant therapy and non-clear cell.
Yeah, so I'll try to tell a little story around adjuvant therapy. It's complicated because we've actually had 4 studies reported out over the course of the past 2 years here, and I sketched out the general schema for each one of them. And there's probably more similarities and differences if you look across the eligibility criteria. So this study is near and dear to my heart. We published this in The Lancet last year, Emotion 010. So this actually looks at patients, and this is a key criteria to look at, T2 grade 4 and T3 disease on up, and also patients with resected metastatic disease. The eligibility criteria I'm emphasizing here because of the consistency across trials, but this study was just dead negative. So adjuvant atezolizumab doesn't seem to work. The next study I'll review is one that you've highlighted already, Neil, which is CheckMate 914. We saw some updates at ASCO this year. Very, very similar eligibility criteria, T2 grade 4 on up. Adjuvant Nevo-Ipi, in the case of this particular study, doesn't seem to work. And we talked about toxicity maybe being a driver of that. Third study here is PROSPER. A lot of people wondering how single agent Nevo might play out. And there is an arm of that previous study, 914, that's going to look at adjuvant nivolumab versus placebo. This was an interesting design around perioperative therapy. Dave can speak to this better than I can, but there's been some data for perioperative immunotherapy in melanoma, for instance. Here, with a single dose of nivolumab, followed by surgery, followed by continued nivolumab versus observation, again, dead negative. So you look at these three trials, and it doesn't really give you a lot of hope for adjuvant immunotherapy in renal cell. But what really has stood out so far is the data from a fourth trial, which is the KEYNOTE-564 study. So this is adjuvant pembrolizumab versus placebo. Pembrolizumab dosed at doses that are familiar to all of us for a period of 1 year. And that study was actually positive for disease-free survival. There was a trend towards overall survival advantage in the context of that study. So I thought that was quite impressive. And there's lots of reasons why the others might have been negative. 010, for instance, was looking at a PD-L1 inhibitor versus a PD-1 inhibitor, smaller sample size. The PROSPER study, which looked at that neoadjuvant versus adjuvant design, ultimately pulled in a lower risk group of patients. CheckMate 914, as we alluded to with adjuvant nivo-ipi, lots of toxicity there. So many, many reasons for which that strategy might not have panned out. I'm going to shift gears here and we'll talk about non-clear cell. And this is, as you'd mentioned, Neil, an area kind of near and dear to my heart. So I spent a lot of time actually focused on this trial early on in my career. So this actually looks at patients with papillary kidney cancer specifically. And the one thing we know about papillary kidney cancer that distinguishes it from clear cell kidney cancer is that it seems to be driven by MET. So we looked at this trial with sunitinib as a control arm versus cabozantinib, crizotinib, and savolitinib. All of those have properties by which they inhibit MET. So it was, I thought, a rational design. Small study, 180 patients in total, but an ambitious study, I would say, in papillary disease. And what we showed here is that there was an improvement, as you can see on the left, in terms of progression-free survival, 9 months with cabozantinib versus about 5 months with sunitinib. There was no advantage with the other MET inhibitors we looked at, crizotinib and savolitinib. If you look at the response rates associated with cabozantinib, clearly better than what we see with sunitinib, around 23% with cabo, 4% with sunitinib. The thing that really strikes me, though, is that if you look at NCCN guidelines, European guidelines, cabozantinib and sunitinib are still kind of neck and neck with one another in the papillary space. So, you know, I think what our community is probably looking for is larger, more definitive trials to really sort of change the current paradigm. So to that end, there have been ambitious studies like SAVOIE, which actually is a randomized phase 2 trial. This looked at patients receiving, again, that same pure MET inhibitor, savolitinib versus sunitinib. But the important point here is they actually try to select out patients who had MET alterations. So it's very difficult to do in these rare histologies. They didn't accrue a ton of patients. Just 60 ultimately were included. But it shows you kind of an interesting signal here. 27% response rate with savolitinib versus just 7% with sunitinib. So that's encouraging. And in fact, there's actually a phase 3 clinical trial that's ongoing called SAMETA that's going to explore the same principle. Combinations, that was a big theme for us when we were talking about clear cell disease today. I think the combination data for non-clear cell disease is pretty encouraging. You know, if you look at the trials, I'll just point out some consistency across them. Cabo-Atezo, Cabo-Nevo, both of these trials have a response rate for papillary that's just, it's identical. It's interesting, 47% there. Data for Bev-Atezo, maybe a little bit less impressive, I would say. It's what you might expect since we don't see the same activity in clear cell, but nonetheless, response rate of 25% in papillary. And then Lenpembro, the data was updated. Doesn't look so different now at ESMO, still impressive with a response rate of 53% in papillary disease. So these combinations are definitely very interesting, good response rates and so forth. There's also combinations that we might be interested in down the line, looking at, you know, MET inhibitors with immunotherapy as they are in the SAMETA trial that I alluded to earlier. So lots of stuff going on in the combo space, but I do think we need more, and that sort of leads into this discussion around zanzalintinib. So zanzalintinib is the newest TKI on the block, also known as XL092. You may ask, why do we need another MET inhibitor? Well, this builds on an interesting premise with cabozantinib. It inhibits a lot of the same targets as cabo. So you've got MET inhibition, you have AXL inhibition and so forth. You also have inhibition of TAM and other kinases with XL092, but a shorter half-life. And, you know, you think about some of the limitations that we have in applying cabozantinib. Maybe some of that has to do with the half-life of the drug, some of the tox that we see with it. So it's going to be interesting to see how it pans out. You know, I think, you know, if we all put our drug development hat on, we know that we're going to have to look for unique settings in which to use this drug. I've been involved pretty early on with this agent in the dose escalation. So this is some of the data that we've presented today. We'll have a lot more in clear cell renal cell coming up. But what we see is an early signal of activity. I'm not going to dive into the minutiae here, but if you look at the swimmer's plot on the right-hand side, what is really interesting to me is that I have had patients on cabozantinib, so a very similar drug when you think about the molecular targets, that have actually responded really well to zanzalintinib. So, you know, it suggests that maybe there's something beyond cabozantinib with respect to the way that the drug acts. And with that in mind, we've launched one of the first trials with zanzalintinib in the context of non-clear cell kidney cancer. And so this is a big phase 3 trial, STELLAR 304. It's actively enrolling right now. Encourage folks to reach out to me if they have any interest in this. But it takes patients who have unresectable metastatic non-clear cell disease, and we're limiting to three subtypes: papillary, unclassified, and translocation RCC. And we're looking at Zanza plus nivolumab versus sunitinib. And people have asked me, well, why is sunitinib control arm here? You know, you just did, you know, studies sort of obviating it in papillary disease like PapMet. And the challenge is that was phase 2, hasn't really led to a guideline change. My goal here is to see if we can kind of get these older drugs like sunitinib, you know, relegated to just the non, you know, sort of level 1 evidence categories and push novel regimens like this forward for non-clear cell patients. So I think I'll wrap up there, Neil.
So my mind always goes to other things I've heard, and it's interesting when you said, do we need another TKI? Have you ever heard of pirtobrutinib? It's a Bruton tyrosine kinase inhibitor, and they, you know, there were three that were already out there. Who needs another BTK? Well, this thing causes a response to people who progress on BTK. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you keep looking, and hopefully you see something. Just to get back to adjuvant therapy for a second, Dave, it's a very interesting editorial in the JCO in the last, I think it was a couple weeks ago, by Ian Tanek, mm-hmm. about the issue this controversial issue of adjuvant to IO. And he kind of came out anti. Any thoughts?
Well, I'm fairly pro-IO in the metastatic setting. I have a very different approach in the adjuvant setting because most of our patients are going to be cured with surgery. So blanket use of these agents should not be, you know, standard of care. And we've already seen how that works in melanoma. So for example, both PD-1s are approved in stage 3 melanoma, but in our practice and in other practices, for 3A patients, we do not advocate for the use of PD-1, even though it's approved there, and that's a large chunk of our patients. Those are patients with micrometastatic lymph node involvement from melanoma. So we have a conversation with patients. We talk about their risk, which might only be 15 or 20% of recurrence, and say, well, this drug might reduce that 40%, but the absolute risk reduction is only 5 or 6%. And do you want to try this? And have a balanced conversation about the risk reduction and the toxicity issues, because some of my worst outcomes with patients have been in the adjuvant setting with dangerous, even life-threatening toxicity. So I have a very different conversation with patients that I think we need to. We also need to do a much better job, as I alluded to before, in picking patients out for this therapy. We struggle in kidney cancer, but it should be based on biology, in my opinion, not stage, not clinical stage. So we need to insist that work gets done so we can narrow the application at a minimum to those patients who are most likely at risk, most likely to benefit.
When you were talking before about your bar to use IO, patient with prior autoimmune disease, I was thinking, I bet you it's a lot different in the adjuvant setting.
Absolutely.
Than metastatic. You're already on the fence to start with, it sounds like, about about adjuvant.
Yeah, no, I wouldn't say I'm on the fence, because I think the Pembro result is a clear result. I just don't think we should be blanket giving it to every single patient, and we need to really educate those people, which is not, because there is real risk. It's usually in the fine print of a lot of these publications, but patients can have very bad outcomes in that setting.
Yeah, and again, when you think about the fact they might be cured, it's terrible.
Right.
Any particular autoimmune complications you want to relate to us?
Well, the ones that are sort of seared in my brain are the ones where patients have actually died with treatment. So I had a patient who once got one dose of PD-1 blockade and got a horrible myositis that affected every muscle, including cardiac muscle. So that patient spent a year on a ventilator before dying.
Wow.
So that's like, that leaves a mark, you know, on the family, on the patient, obviously, but also on the clinicians. So when that, so I think what might happen if melanoma is a guide is in these other tumor types, if we see more bad outcomes in our clinical practice, we might do what we're doing in melanoma, which is try to be more rational about this application.
So some questions that we got in our survey, Monty: adjuvant therapy, non-clear cell, adjuvant therapy after metastectomy.
Yeah, you know, I have to tell you, in the non-clear cell space, not a big fan of adjuvant therapy just because we just don't have any data there. And I'm hard-pressed to think that we'll have studies in the near future that address that, unfortunately.
Dave, treatment of sarcomatoid RCC, we were alluding to that before.
So it's great to have this conversation. Prior to the PD-1 era, these were our patients who did the absolute worst. VEGF TKIs do not do much for these folks. They have very short survivals, but the PD-1 story is very exciting. These are, and we see this in other tumor types as well, where some of the worst biology responds the best. That's probably because these tumors are so aggressive, they generate an immune response, which is being blocked by PD-L1 expression. So we've known for a long time that sarcomatoid tumors have a lot of PD-L1 expression in their microenvironment. So when you come in that setting with a drug that blocks PD-L1 or PD-1, you get a lot of activity, not just in the short term where responses can be north of 50%, but in the, more importantly, in the durable long term, where we look at Ipi-Nivo and PFS at 5 years, 40-45%. Those patients are alive, without progression, without secondary therapy. And in some ways, sarcomatoid is the best biomarker for response that we have. So when we see it, we use it, we get aggressive about immune therapy in those patients.
Interesting. So, Monty, someone has a patient with an ALK mutation with renal cell. Can you use ALK inhibitors? I'll throw in BRCA. Here, you can use PARP in somebody who's got a BRCA mutation.
Yeah, so for the ALK question, I promise I didn't plant it, but I did publish a series on ALK mutated
really?
Renal cell a couple of years ago.
Really?
Yeah, lucky me. But I had three patients with papillary RCC, so now there's actually an official World Health Organization designated a subset of renal cell that's ALK altered.
Wow.
It's an exquisitely rare population. It's a needle in a haystack, but if you find it in my series, actually, patients responded to alectinib very well. Mm-hmm. We actually had some patients who'd failed prior VEGF inhibitors put them on alectinib, and really a transformative response. Not necessarily a durable response, right, but a good response nonetheless. You know, your question around PARP is an interesting one. I have a colleague, Yasser Gad at Hopkins, who's very interested in this question. You do see a reasonable proportion, not a very high proportion of patients with DDR alterations and renal cell carcinoma, but the data that I'm aware of for PARP and renal cell isn't particularly encouraging.
We were talking, Dave, before about c-MET, and of course in lung they've got a couple of MET inhibitors, they got a bispecific. What about c-MET mutated RCC?
Yeah, I think Monty's work suggests you should try to block both VEGF and MET at the same time, and more selective agents are not necessarily more active. So I would go with what Monty was suggesting, which is something like cabozantinib, which gets both of those targets.
So questions about, I don't know if you would call it Zanza. We always try to look for nicknames, these things, and I can't remember how to say it. A lot of questions about that. Where do you see that heading? There's a phase 3 trial right now?
There is. So that was that non-clear cell study that I alluded to. And I'm sure there's going to be more in the works for Zanza or Z-squared. I'm trying to think of a good, cool, catchy name. But I do think that there's still other potential applications for drugs. I always think that the ultimate trial that we really need to do now in renal cell carcinoma is a trial that uses molecular selection. I mean, Dave's contributed a ton to this body of evidence that looks at genomic profiling and associates signatures with patients who are driven by angiogenesis versus patients that are driven by, for instance, immune-related pathways. And given the equipoise that we have now, looking at regimens like Nivo-Ipi versus TKI plus IO, I think it's more important than ever that we start looking at some of the work that you've done, Dave, in a prospective fashion. And maybe that's where a drug like Zanza gets integrated.
Right.
Who knows?
Interesting. So some more questions we were talking about autoimmune toxicities. Someone has a patient who got ipi-nivo, David, and got hypoadrenalism, hypothyroidism. And we were talking about this in the lung cancer program the other day. Any data between correlation of immune-related adverse, this is an age-old question, and efficacy. On the Friday night in lung, they were saying maybe skin toxicity specifically is associated with benefit.
Yeah, in kidney cancer, I don't know that we know of a specific tox that leads to a greater, you know, improved outcomes. I think in general, immune toxicity is associated with better outcomes. You're essentially breaking tolerance in those patients. But aggressive treatment of the toxicity, I think the important point, does not shut off that immune response. So if you see something, it's worsening, we have to act. You know, we do much more holding of treatment if we see mild toxicity. Because if you give a dose of Nevo or Nevo-Ipi in the setting of mild tox, you'll almost certainly make that worse. So skin tox gets worse, diarrhea gets worse. So I often tell the patients, as long as you're having side effects, you're on the drug. You know, your immune system is boosted. It's going to do what it's going to do. And I don't try to push. And we are aggressive about immune suppression to get things under control, knowing that it's not necessarily going to cause their disease to grow.
We also had a question about, you know, there's been this interest out there, Monty, in the issue of antibiotics and IOs. Mm-hmm. What's your take on that? Do you try to limit antibiotics in your patients on IOs?
Yeah, you know, I do try to use it only if it's necessary. I feel like that body of evidence is pretty clear now. Yep. There have been large-scale meta-analyses, not just in renal cell, but also incorporating patients with lung cancer and melanoma, and really does suggest some diminution of effects, even trying to control for other comorbidities and factors that lead to antibiotic use. So unless we absolutely need to do it, I avoid it. I will say, at this ASCO meeting, we had some interesting data. One of my fellows presented data related to a live bacterial product, actually an oral probiotic, if you will, mm-hmm. that seems to complement the activity of Cabo-Nevo. A couple of years ago, we published in Nature Medicine a paper that looked at Nevo-Ipi with the same probiotic that augmented outcomes. So I'm glad you touched on, you know, antibiotics and the microbiome, because I do think it might be a part of the future of kidney cancer and other diseases.
Interesting. Let's see if we can take a couple more questions from the oncologist. But I promised everybody I would tell you, we have the abstract. Tumor Treating Fields, Second Line Therapy. I know these guys are like, what are we talking about? Second Line Therapy in non-small cell. A lot of people out there. So then the question is, they have a phase 3 trial. They're reporting a survival benefit. What everybody want to know is, what's the hazard rate? So this is what I'm reading. The presentation's later this morning, 0.74. So not bad, not a home run. Can't wait to see what people have to say about it. Who knows, maybe it's going to come to renal cell. All right, let's get back to immune-related toxicity. So David, somebody has a 65-year-old man, got ipi-nivo myocarditis. You were talking about some of the life-threatening complications. What have you seen in terms of IOs in the heart?
Well, those toxicities are rare, but they are dangerous and potentially life-threatening. Part of the problem is being suspicious of it. So they often can present, for example, with just profound fatigue. And when someone has fatigue with IO, it just could be the drug. Fatigue is one of the most common side effects. But fatigue could also mean myocarditis. It could mean the, you know, hypothyroidism. It could be panhypopit. So it's all about suspecting, you know, in someone with new fatigue.
But they're really in heart failure.
Yeah. And so you've got to be checking, you know, CPKs, you know, that sort of thing, troponins in those patients. You've got to be on the lookout because early intervention matters. And if you miss that issue, like in the patient I was describing who had that complication, she went to the ER, didn't get a cardiac workup, and then, you know, went downhill pretty quickly. It's all about, you know, prior suspicion. If you think this could happen, it can be detected. They're now exploring novel agents beyond steroids for patients with myocarditis. There's a whole group of cardiologists across the country have come together to try to deal with this because we're going to be seeing it more now that we're bringing these drugs to so many different indications and bringing it earlier. So we need more research. We need more novel agents.
So, Monty, another question about itching. Do you see it with IOs? The person wants to know about acetylcysteine, photodynamic therapy, naloxone. Have you seen severe cases of pruritus with IOs?
You know, I certainly have, I mean, to the point that, and this is a side effect that oftentimes lingers and bothers patients well into their duration of treatment. So I've considered, if the patient's having a good response, discontinuing on occasion, you know, if they're doing well. I think the topical steroids have been more than enough for the vast majority of my patients. I don't, Dave, have you used any of those other strategies?
We have, and when topical therapy doesn't work, so some patients have needed those agents for symptomatic control because it becomes a major quality of life issue and doesn't always go away quickly. So I've actually had a couple of patients needing steroids for that problem, which is something you would like to try to avoid for something that's not life-threatening, but it can be certainly life-altering to have that kind of itching every day, all the times of the day. It prevents people from sleeping. You know, once again, it's all about integrating your care with your derm team and doing prospective research, because most of what we have for these rare cases are anecdotal reports, and that's probably not good enough for us to get sort of a unified approach for this.
So Monty and Dave, thank you so much for working with us today. Audience, thank you for attending. Coming back next week after we recover from this ASCO craziness. We're going to talk about GI cancers on June the 14th. Be safe, stay well, and have a great day. Thanks a lot, guys. Great. Appreciate it.
Thanks for inviting.